It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host. This is episode 35. Welcome back to a discussion of classic films. Today, we're talking about Laura from 1944. I can't do that alone, so I had to call up some friends from Edmonton, Canada, all the way from Texas to Alberta. It's almost like an oil pipeline of podcasting. And I'm joined by Erica Ensign from Edmonton. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I'm happy to be sending my my voice down the internet pipeline straight to you to talk about what is one of my favorite movies of all time.
That's so exciting to hear. I can't wait to hear your thoughts. And also joining us from Edmonton is Annette Weirstra. Hello.
Hello. I just feel like I've learned some new information that this is one of Erica's favorite movies, and I did not know.
I know that. I don't know why I didn't have you over to watch it with me.
Right.
Like, that was a real oversight on my part, because I got to tell you, the Blu-ray looks fantastic. Ooh. It was the first time I'd watched the actual Blu-ray of it, and holy moly.
And then you could have DM'd me and said, Shelley, aren't you jealous? Because we're watching Laura together all the way down there.
It would have been too much, really.
In the Texas
too much.
In the North.
it's true. We're having wine. We're having a nice time.
Uh-huh.
Or cocktails poured out of a cheap bottle of scotch, maybe. I don't
know.
Well, let's talk about Laura from 1944, produced and directed by Otto Preminger, starring Gene Tierney as the dead heroine of the film, Dana Andrews as a detective, and Clifton Webb and Vincent Price as Clifton Webb, Vincent Price types. We'll get to all that. And because this is a mystery, I feel compelled to say, and I don't say it every time, even though I feel like it's self-evident, this is going to be all spoilery. If you haven't seen Laura, please go see it, because I'm not going to wait till the end to tell you how it ends, besides it's a great movie. So just go see it. Stop what you're doing right now if you haven't seen it. Because we're probably going to spoil it within moments.
and this is a movie that's very, like, you don't want to know what's happening before
you
really
do it. Yeah, absolutely. Although when you see it the second time after you do know, it's fun. So
it is, very much so. I will tell you, the reason that I watched this movie in the first place is because I was a huge Twin Peaks fan. I love Twin Peaks.
Right.
And somewhere along the line, I learned that one of the big influences on David Lynch for making Twin Peaks was the movie Laura. And I was like, well, okay, obviously the title right there, because Laura Palmer is the character who dies. And the detective who I am in love with in Twin Peaks has fallen in love with this dead girl to some extent. And that sort of idea came from this movie Laura, where the detective is investigating the death of a beautiful woman who has a big portrait that you see all the time. And I'm very glad that I didn't know anything else going into the movie the first time I saw it.
Have you've seen it for the first time a long time ago, back when you were watching Twin Peaks? Or
So like the 1990s.
Journey. And Annette, is this your first time seeing it?
Yeah, this is my first time. The only thing I knew was that it was about a murder. Detective fell in love with the person he was investigating the murder. So I just, you know, that's all I knew. And can I spoil things already?
If you want to, feel free.
Well, so then, you know, at the point when Laura shows up and she's not dead, I was like, is this a ghost? I think is he falling? Like, he's now having vision. Is he having a dream? I was like, so I was just like ready for it to get like a little bit surreal and crazy, because I could not get my head around the fact that she wasn't dead. So that was kind of fun, because it just was just boggled my mind. I'm like, it's not that uncommon of a trope, but it just, in this movie, in this case, I had no idea it was. And it just like threw me so far off what I was thinking. And then it just got better from there.
Yeah, that was my experience the first time I saw it, too. So I'm right there with you.
Because the movie immediately plants its foot in the ground and says, Laura's dead. And that's what we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then later you find out she's not. But the movie is very heavily invested in your believing that she's dead. And you really have no reason to believe she isn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they found her body. She's there, right? So it's all... It's all clear she's dead. So Laura is a very young woman. And I think age is interesting in this movie. Gene Tierney is 24 when she makes this movie. She's playing a character who's 22-ish. And all of the men circling around in her orbit are considerably older than her. Clifton Webb is 55. And Dana Andrews and Vincent Price are in their 30s. But there's a whole lot of sort of the young, unattainable beauty after whom all these men are sort of in gaga lust. It's not sort of that they're, you know, lecherous horn dogs. They're all kind of like, oh, Laura, Laura. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a weird, especially since you don't see her, since she's dead. Everything you know about Laura is from the point of view of these people who knew her.
Which is interesting because I've seen this movie a bunch of times, but it had been a while since I had last seen it. And this time, of course, I was watching it with my podcast hat on. So I was like watching a little bit closer and, you know, noticing things how, yes, as we are learning about Laura, much of the voiceover is coming from Clifton Webb. And I was thinking, oh, right. You know, this movie is sort of from Waldo Leidecker's perspective. And then I'm like, no, it's not. It's from the perspective of the detective, of Mark McPherson. And like, there are so many layers of POV in this movie that are just fascinating to me because it's never actually shifts POV because it's always from his POV. But because it is told so skillfully, sometimes you know, you're seeing somebody else's POV through his POV, and there's just layers and layers, mm-hmm. and it's really good. Yeah, this is why it's one of my favorite movies. And interestingly, I discovered, unfortunately, after his death, that it was one of my grandfather's favorite movies as well. So I thought that was pretty cool, like a neat thing that I found out.
Yeah, the structure of the movie, you're in present day, and we're going to investigate who killed Laura and how that happened. And then at some point, one of these POV switches is that we go back in time with Clifton Webb. We have a bit of a flashback, and it's a forward-moving flashback. In other words, the flashback doesn't all take place in the same instant. It moves forward through the time of their acquaintance. And then when the flashback is over, we go back to present day. And then we're much more in the POV of the detective as we go, who's played by Dana Andrews, as we go forward. But the thing about Clifton Webb's character is he's always there. He's a pest. And he's just like, and Dana Andrews lets him tag along as he's investigating the crime. So it's not just when Clifton Webb is being interrogated. He just, at the very beginning of the movie, he's just like, can I go along? And Dana Andrews is like, sure, no problem. Which strikes me as odd.
I thought that was hilarious because it's like classic amateur detective thing where like, why are you letting this person tag along in the investigation? Because there is no, like, especially since he is definitely a suspect, you should not have suspects tagging along in the investigation, but it happens all the time. So you go like, okay.
I thought that was like, I thought that was like a pro move because he wanted to,
because he didn't trust
Clifton Webb's character. He didn't trust Waldo Leidecker. He wanted to watch his reactions just as, you know, to what other people are saying just as much. And also, like, you know, Leidecker does have a point. He knows all of these people because he, you know, helped put them all in Laura's orbit. So it is interesting that he is also there. And I guess I should say, yeah, the movie is not just from the detective's point of view, because we do have those few scenes toward the very end where you see Waldo on the stairs trying to, you know, that amazing shot of him at the top of the stairs with his shadow behind him the wall, you know, kind of deciding, is he going to go down the stairs or turn around, et cetera. And I guess, Dane Andrews' character would not have been able to see that.
So Waldo is a great character who we meet very early in the movie. He's the first voice we hear because he's the one that says, Laura died. I didn't write down the line, but he basically tells us that Laura died and it's...
I'll never forget the day she died or something.
Right. Something like that. And then the first scene we see is Dana Andrews' detective walking into Leidecker's very lavish, large apartment. But we don't see him. We see all of his stuff and you hear Leidecker's voice off screen and he calls him into his opulent bathroom and Leidecker is sitting in a bathtub typing.
It's so great. And it's like a big marble middle-of-the-room Romanesque tub.
That's a hell of a New York apartment. I mean, of course. Yes.
Obviously.
And a 55-year-old man with his shirt off. And I mean, good for you, Clifton Webb.
Yeah, and he's perfectly comfortable. Like, he just... From moment one, we recognize that he feels like he is in charge of any situation that he is in. Mm-hmm. And that's made very clear by the fact that he's just in the bath. And then just like he just gets out of the bath and says, hey, can you hand me that washcloth? Can you hand me that robe? And interestingly enough, like, obviously you don't see him standing up out of the bathtub, but you do see McPherson like looking at him
checking
him up and down as he gets out of the bathtub. And I was like, wow, I'd forgotten that.
And Webb's character clearly intends that to happen. So, because Webb's whole thing, Lydecker's whole thing is he's throwing this guy off balance. He doesn't have any respect for Miss McPherson. The class consciousness that is apparent throughout the whole movie begins right here. There's all these sort of little jibes about McPherson, the middle class guy, and the working class, I guess, which I guess is even more of an insult. And then McPherson has his little puzzle that he's playing with, and a little baseball puzzle. It's like, oh, it's a Game Boy from 1944.
That's exactly what Steven said. He was like, oh, God, boys and their Game Boys.
So, yeah, he throws him off balance. And then as we meet the rest of the characters, Waldo is just tagging along. And I really like the business in that scene where they meet, too. After he starts he has his robe on for a bit, and then he puts on his clothes item by item. And he just has him dressing while he's dressing down McPherson, so to speak. And it's just really well done, real well choreographed by the actors and by the director.
Well, it also sets him up like he's just believes he's in control of this situation, and he is in control of all of not just his own life, but of those around him. And that becomes more and more apparent. It just is like he is a guy who is all about control. And it's just a good setup.
Yeah, the fact that the first visual that we get is McPherson walking through Lydecker's stuff. All of the people around him are just more stuff to him. Like he is very conscious of, you know, people sort of as possessions, Laura as especially, you know, beautiful things, which is why when we get to the point where he wants his three things back, the vase and the clock and the fireplace grate, like you don't at first, you kind of don't blink twice and be like, there's no other reason he'd want those back, but because he just likes his stuff, which we get from moment one.
Yeah. And we follow along as McPherson and Lydecker go to meet the other suspects, which is a good way to just introduce us to all of our important characters. We meet Judith Anderson as Laura's aunt. We also meet Vincent Price as her fiancé, Shelby. I forgot his last name for a second. Carpenter is his last name. And Vincent Price, it's not his first film by any means, but it is pretty close to his first starring role. And he's doing this sort of interesting Southern accent-ish thing. Sometimes at some points in the movie, he kind of loses it.
Yeah, he's supposed to be from Kentucky, and that's not exactly a Kentucky accent.
Right. And again, age is interesting to me, too, because Vincent Price and Dana Andrews, probably about the same age, mid-30s. Judith Anderson, who has a thing for Vincent Price, who was also engaged to Laura. I'm doing that thing again where I mix up character names and actor names. Anne has a thing for Shelby, who was engaged to Laura. And Laura is younger than Shelby, who is younger than Anne. So, and I think we're supposed to notice that.
And the fact that Anne is her aunt, it's an interesting family dynamic because, you know, we learn from Lydecker that he sort of, you know, helped make Laura. But at the same time, obviously, Laura was already kind of in this sort of social class because her aunt and Treadwell is, you know, obviously richy rich and throwing lots of fancy parties and has enough money to take money out and just give it to Shelby when he needs some because she likes him so much. So it's an interesting thing that I noticed this time. That's like, yeah, okay, Laura probably wouldn't have become the huge business success as quickly as she did without Lydecker. What does he do? He's like
sponsoring her, introducing her to people. Well, and that's funny because when we get to the flashback, we see how she and Lydecker met, and she's got a job as an ad agency, and they basically say it happened 5 years ago, so she was 17, which is like, wait, what? We give jobs to ad people at ad agencies when they're 17? Okay.
Maybe if your aunt is Anne Treadwell.
Well, that's right. That's a good point. And that's what I was kind of getting to, because the way they have her costumed and dressed, she looks a little frumpy. She's got a big coat on. She's got sort of a hat pulled down over her face. I think she's purposely intended to be the closed flower that will eventually blossom into something beautiful. And I feel like they go a little too far with that, especially given that connection where, yeah, Anne Treadwell's wealth probably gave her entree into that business. And Laura gives the physical impression of somebody who's, you know, maybe not from New York or maybe not very experienced, although she does have the gumption to go to find Lydecker at lunch and say, will you endorse this product that my ad agency is repping, which is a pretty good scam, you know, mm-hmm. if she can get him to sign on the dotted line, which is apparently all that's required, because eventually he does it. He says he won't do it at first. But apparently all you have to do is sign a piece of paper and then everybody gets paid.
I mean, hey, that sounds good to me.
Right?
I'm in the wrong business.
I thought it was interesting because he takes so much credit for creating Laura and how smart she was at business and doing all those introductions. But I'm like, when I saw that scene, I felt like, well, she's pretty smart herself already and played him like a little violin. And why wouldn't she have eventually figured it out on her own? So it doesn't hurt, especially since she already has other connections in that community. So it's like he's, and because you're kind of getting his perspective, I feel like he's overrating his own
mm-hmm. a little bit,
you know, although, but that's just sort of like, of course he's taking all the credit.
Although this time I actually noticed in the dialogue something that I hadn't really noticed before, and that's where he specifically calls out that while he gave her the boost, he actually says that she is the one who did the work herself, that he didn't actually, like, business wise, that he didn't catapult her to, you know, fame in business. That was just her, because she had this, you know, light about her and this presence and that she was so smart and stuff. So I feel like he's not taking as much credit for her rise in business as I thought he was originally, but I do still think that he's taking an inordinate amount of credit in terms of her rise in society, especially thinking about how her aunt was already sort of in that realm. Then again, it also mentions that Anne Treadwell's parties have people from like every strata of society. So it is possible that Laura was actually sort of from a, you know, sort of lower echelon of society, and her aunt was a little bit higher up, and they were still close because her aunt mixes and matches with people from, you know, all over, up and down the ladder.
I mean, and every might be stretching it. It might
I believe that
upper
is
middle
the case.
Class and mm-hmm. lower class rich or something.
Yeah, right. every strata of society that matters to Waldo Leidecker, who is doing the narration.
Am I lower class rich?
Maybe.
What does that mean?
I don't know. We'll work on that. But this is, I think, the point at which we have to talk about the performances, because what we learn about Jean Tierney as Laura, especially before we know that she's alive, is all about what an amazing person. I mean, in the flashback, of course, we see her. So we get some sense of what sort of a person she was. But she's still being explained to us by the people in her world. And Jean Tierney is a very young, not particularly experienced actress, and mm-hmm. is, in my opinion, from the performance point of view, the weak link in the movie. Because all this stuff about how smart and clever she is, it doesn't really come out in her character, in her acting, nor does the reason that all these men are sort of falling all over herself. She's very beautiful, and mm-hmm. the portrait is the absolute most beautiful image of her in the whole film. She looks great in the scenes after she's sort of come up in the world, but she's not somebody who you look at and go, wow, that's I get why all these men are being stupid over her.
Mm-hmm. It's I mean, they lean very heavily on the fact that she was a physical beauty, mm-hmm. and, you know, which is how she got, you know, discovered twice because she was just like that striking to look at. And she, you know, had to work much, much harder to follow it up with the acting, which is why I think that this is kind of a perfect movie for her, because a lot of it just revolves around the reflection of her and other people's thoughts about her. And she doesn't have to do all that much in terms of carrying a character. You know, like, this is not your Katharine Hepburn sort of like sparkly fast talking. This is, for the most part, just a girl who is going about her business. And I want to talk about her performance in the flashback scene specifically, because this time I'm wondering, is the performance also supposed to reflect the fact that we are seeing this through at least one different POV? Because we have Waldo talking about how he, you know, believes that all other men are beneath her and she shouldn't be with them. So the first guy, the painter who painted the picture of her, you know, that she's with when she's supposed to be with Waldo, and he writes a really scathing piece about him. And after that, Laura can't possibly see him the same again. We see a medium shot of Laura read, I think it's like over breakfast in bed, and she's reading this article and she's laughing with what I found was kind of an uncomfortable amount of delight. Like, here's a guy that she was kind of falling for, and now she's reading this, you know, article skewering him, and she's taking a lot of glee in it. And in my head, I'm like, I really hope that that is just the Waldo Leidecker version of what Laura was actually doing in that moment, because I find it hard to find her like such a sweet, caring person that she's supposed to be and that she's described as by other people when she's laughing like that the next day about a guy that she was supposedly kind of falling in love with. So I just, that's a bit of the film that I hadn't noticed before. And I wonder, do you guys think that, or is it just that maybe, you know, Gene Tierney was not quite up on the acting yet at that point, and it just sort of did whatever seemed natural at the time?
I don't know. I feel like it's either the Leidecker POV, or remember that once we find out that she's alive, we have another murder to solve. And so as one of the suspects for the murder, you have to believe that she's somebody who has a sort of a secret side, a dark side. And we've already learned that, you know, she's quote unquote cheating on Waldo Leidecker. So maybe that's an indicator of it. And then the fact that she has some, you know, gleeful reaction, and she's still his friend after he skewers this person who painted this beautiful portrait of her. So clearly she has ambition. She may have a darker side. And you know, that's kind of the way I took it.
Good point.
You could, based on the ending of the movie, though, where she basically expresses the control he's had over her, is that she's playing a part, which would fit with Erica's theory, where it's like, I am laughing because even if I'm not happy, because I don't know what he'll do to me if I don't play along, and I don't have enough power in this situation to just like walk away at this point.
That's true. The relationship between her and Leidecker could certainly be abusive. He treats other people in an abusive manner, and is the lines that he's given are very much indicative of the fact that he's extremely selfish. And I forget exactly what he says, but basically, like, nobody else, what anybody else says doesn't matter. It's all about me. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, admits that. And even the way he expresses his love for Laura is like, I made her, I created her. And it's clearly an obsession with him.
Yeah, and he says that he tried to become a better, kinder person for her, but I don't really buy it. Like, he's, you know, he says that, and I feel like for him, all that means is that every once in a while he would think, Laura would probably like it if I was a kinder person, and then he moves along to whatever is coming next in his day.
Exactly. And it should be, and he was nominated for an Oscar, and he is the standout performance, Clifton Webb's character in this movie. Absolutely. The movie really pivots on him. Other people who were considered to be cast for the movie, George Sanders, who, if you've ever seen All About Eve, or Laird Krieger, who played Jack the Ripper in a preview. He was sort of a super creepy take on it. So it's interesting how much the way you feel about the movie aesthetically kind of depends on who plays that part. And Clifton Webb, who was a gay man, comes off as somewhat effete. It doesn't seem like his relationship with Laura is about sexual passion. It seems like it's more about control, and this is something that I created. And I am, you know, frankly, as much fun as he is to watch, I am distracted by the fact that I believe he's a gay man that's just not talking about being a gay man.
I found that I noticed that, but I wasn't distracted by it, because to me it was very clear that the thing that he cared about was that Laura was a beautiful thing, which we know that he likes, and that he, you know, created her and had all this control and stuff. So that he wanted her to view him in a, you know, in a romantic way, so that he could basically truly own her in terms of, you know, just getting married and being like, yes, see, not only does she, you know, visit me every Tuesday and Friday and we go out all the time, but she is truly, truly mine. And even though there's not any whiff of like a romantic love, he does love her as, you know, the same way he loves the iron fireplace grate or whatever or that
which is a super weird thing to want back, but
yes it is.
it's probably you know, hand carved by some special person in some other country, and he just really like it's a beautiful thing, just like Laura.
I guess so. Let's take Vincent Price apart for a minute there, shall we? So Vincent Price as Shelby Carpenter. We initially know, as we've spoken about before, that Judith Anderson's character, Anne, has a thing for him, even though he's engaged to Laura. And it sort of unravels as we meet him that it's funny because we're told that his feelings for Laura are not necessarily genuine, that he's out for what he can get. We learn later that he took a cigarette case she gave him and then gave it to somebody else who then pawned it. And so we learn he's a bad guy. But if you just watch Vincent Price walking through the movie, he doesn't give you that impression. He actually seems kind of adorable to me. I don't know about how you guys felt about him, but you know he's bad because people say he is, but he's either the performance or the things they've given him to do. There's never a moment where he's like, all right, you got me. I'm kind of a sleazy dude.
I think the reason that he's so successful at being a sleazy dude is because he doesn't come off
right
as a sleazy dude.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And you know, I feel like he genuinely does love Laura. Like, he cares for her a lot, so much so that he is, you know, rushing off to her cabin to hide the gun that he gave her because he
right.
genuinely thinks she's a murderer, which shows you that, yes, he cares about her. And yes, he's a bad guy because he's totally willing to marry a murderess and just help her get away with it. But at the same time, I think he's just one of those people that, like, he's got enough love for the whole world, man. He can totally invite what was her name, the other girl, Diane Redfern. He can totally invite Diane Redfern over to Laura's apartment, and they were not just talking for 3 hours if Diane Redfern is wearing Laura's like negligee and stuff. I'm sorry, that's not the way that worked out. But so he's, you know, they've got the cheap booze and he's got this other girl, and he's got enough love for her, he's got enough love for Anne, he's got enough love for Laura. Like, he just goes wherever the wind blows him because that's just the kind of easy going, happy go lucky guy he is. He's not super sleazy. He's just who he is.
I thought he was just also super smart. So he was playing all of them to sort of have a lot of angles. So I didn't see it as love. I saw it as like plans. He just had a lot of plans. And like you said, he was very charming. It was super interesting to see a Vincent Price movie before he was Vincent Price. And it took me a minute to recognize him because he's such a baby.
I know. I think that's why I like him so
much. I thought
he
was just smart.
I also
felt like he was our red herring pretty early on, and I was just like, well, he didn't do it. He's too.
Oh,
he's got other plans. He would not do that. He's got so many plans going. He would just, you know. So he was our red herring.
So the thing about where Diane Redfern and Shelby going to Laura's apartment for no good reason. They were going to fool around, obviously. But beyond that,
some
talk
might call
about,
that a good reason. Just,
well, okay, you're a good point.
You know,
point. But beyond that, it felt to me like, in addition to, obviously, we never meet Diane Redfern because she's the one who was killed in place of Laura. Mm-hmm. But in addition to her sort of inhabiting Laura's space and wearing her negligee because that's what one wears when one fools around, mm-hmm. it also seems like maybe she had. Maybe it was sort of a creating a replacement for Laura. Like, I'm going to wear, she wore shoes too. I'm wearing her shoes.
Yes,
I'm wearing
mules.
Her negligee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in her apartment. I admire this woman, which is sort of an All About Eve kind of thing in that, you know, mm-hmm. I don't only want to take over this woman. I want to be this woman, right? She has, and so they don't explore that. But that's the, I guess the first or second time I saw this movie, that's what I thought, because I was focused less on the fact that she and Shelby are messing around, which clearly they are, and more on the fact that Diane Redfern, who is a model who works for Laura, may have some sort of obsessive relationship to Laura herself.
There's like another entire movie set, you know, like just a little bit askew from this one that's all about Diane Redfern and her trying to, you know, steal Shelby Carpenter away and become Laura. And it ends tragically with her death. And then we get this movie that starts right afterwards.
I love it. I would watch that. Laura mm-hmm. Richard. Yeah. Diane. Well, wait.
No, same plot.
We'll workshop that title.
Yes.
Well, I think we talked a little bit about the visual look of the film and the cinematography, especially toward the end. But were there other things, whether they have to be to do with costumes or sets or shots that either of you guys noticed or were impressed by?
My favorite thing is the painting and how the painting is, you know, how it's framed throughout the movie. Because, you know, during the first half, when we think that she's dead, you have, you know, you've got a lot of longing looks from McPherson staring up at the painting and stuff. But also when he is in that room and talking to other people, he's always framed so that the painting is in frame, like kind of over his shoulder, like looking over his shoulder. It's behind him or he's looking at it, etc. But after Laura comes back, he's almost always standing right in front of the painting. Mm-hmm. He's no longer framed as sharing space with that dead version of Laura. He's now sharing space with the real Laura. Like, there's a really interesting two shot of them where he is talking to the real Laura and the painting is now almost entirely obscured by his head, depending on, you know, if he moves just the teeniest, tiniest bit, like it still sort of peeks out. But for the most part, he's standing in front of it. And then for the rest of the film, he's almost always framed directly in front of that portrait. And I thought that was just such a beautiful touch that I don't think I noticed it the first few times I watched, but after seeing it a bunch of times, like I started looking for little bits and pieces like that. And I think that's a nice thematic touch that he is, yes, he was falling for the idea of this woman, but now she's back and he is legitimately putting that behind him and getting to know the actual person and paying attention to her, which is, I think, a nice subtle cue that helps reinforce the romance between them, because there's not a lot of time for it to play out to show you that they actually do, you know, come together and care for each other. So any tiny little directorial flourish that's going to give me, you know, another brick to stick in that wall that, yes, they actually do care about each other. Yes, they are really coming together is helpful because it happens real fast.
I did not notice that, and I feel like now I have to watch that again and see.
Oh, we can watch it anytime.
The Blu-ray. Okay, deal. Deal.
The painting is interesting. So the little trivia about that, they apparently had painted a portrait of Jean Tierney that they didn't, the studio or Preminger, I think, because Preminger took over as director at some point during the making of this movie, and he didn't like the painting. And so what they did was they took an actual photograph of Tierney that the studio had taken, and they put oil on it in places. Ooh. So it's made to look like an oil painting, but it's this giant photograph. Hmm. And of course, it's a full-size oil painting above the mantelpiece of this 24-year-old woman, which is just sort of a fascinating idea that, like, this is the main feature of her apartment. It's which is, again, a quite a nice apartment. Everybody lives extremely well in this, in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, the first, you know, time we see the camera kind of pan through and it goes, you know, through the different rooms, I was like, my God, this apartment is amazing. Like, how can she afford this? And Steven just leans over and goes, well, she only had to pay for three walls. I was like, shut up.
Plus the cottage in Connecticut that we see, which doesn't look half bad either.
Yep.
It's good to be rich or upper middle class or whatever. New York in the 40s. And it's the 40s, by the way. It's one of the few movies that comes out in the middle of World War II that doesn't even acknowledge that World War II happened. But anyway.
I did feel like the sets, because usually I want to talk about the frocks, but in this case, the sets really stuck out for me because they were so opulent and there was a lot of aspirational spaces, which kind of makes sense because I think everyone's sort of aspiring two things in this movie, all the characters.
Yeah, and I think partly because Jean Tierney is, in the first half of the movie, we think she's dead and we have flashback scenes to where she's rising in society. And the second half of the movie, it takes place over a very short period of time, so there's not a lot of opportunity for gratuitous costume changes. She looks great in some of those outfits, but that's not the kind of movie it is. It's not an outfit showpiece. In fact, I noticed the men's costuming more because first there's the scene with Lydecker who's getting dressed and who always has a carnation in his jacket, and then McPherson who doesn't look bad. He doesn't look rumpled. In fact, I think he looks pretty good, but he's definitely supposed to be down market. And, you know, Vincent Price as Shelby looks just well put together, and he's always got a nice suit on, and, you know, everybody looks good. But I think you're right. I think it's the sets that are really the star.
Yeah, there's one particular scene when we think she's still dead and McPherson is sitting at the desk and I think like reading the diary and stuff, and there's a lamp, you know, that's a very racist lamp, but, you know, 40s, is basically framed as like the focal point of that shot. Steven was like, did the lamp pay for this scene? Like, it's the star of this movie all of a sudden. And because it really is center stage, and you can't like, you know, yes, it's useful because it is shedding actual light on McPherson's face and the desk and everything like that. And but you also see it again later in a later scene from a different angle where you can see how racist it actually is. And it is just this like very frilly, frothy ribbons and lace sort of thing up top. And it's just it is very emblematic of the rest of the apartment that is full of just opulent, beautiful, glorious things. It's funny, too, because when McPherson walks into the bathroom at the very beginning, and Waldo Leidecker's, you know, he's like, oh, you know, this is quite a nice place. And he just, Leidecker snaps back, it's lavish. And it's like, okay, we get it. Yes, yes, it's
yes,
lavish.
Lavish. All right, I'll write that down in my notebook that I have. Mm-hmm. And we can't talk about Laura without talking about the music, by which I mean one phrase that repeats over and over. A wonderful phrase. My favorite iteration of the phrase is when they're at the restaurant and it plays, it's got sort of a tango backbeat. And I just like, oh, that's such a good idea. And I can't decide whether it's wonderful and haunting and I love it or whether they do it a little bit too much throughout the movie.
I'm in the love it camp. I just think it's beautiful because if you're not really listening for it, you don't actually notice it. I never noticed that it was that thing that repeated until, I don't know, I'd seen it a whole bunch of times and then, I don't know, watched like an interview about it or read something about it that where they were talking about the music and I was like, oh, right. Like it is a thing that I recognize and, you know, it was, it came out. Like it was played on the radio. It basically became a hit single. A version.
Yeah, after the fact, Johnny Mercer wrote words for it afterwards. So at the it's written by a studio guy basically over the weekend, and then it becomes the theme of the movie. And then later on, Johnny Mercer, who's a pretty prolific composer of the era, writes lyrics, and it becomes essentially a jazz standard. Everybody's covered that song because of the words that Johnny Mercer put on it.
Mm-hmm. But the you know, it's the that melody that is right there. And like watching it this time, it's like, oh, yeah, it does sort of repeat again and again throughout. And that is a thing that I have become fond of just in television these days is when, you know, the theme of the show plays during key moments of, you know, things that are happening in the television show. So having that happen in a movie from 1944 was, I just thought, kind of lovely, like the repeat of that same phrase over and over, because it's, you know, it's also sort of reflective of the movie. The movie is called Laura. It is all about Laura. And we are just like constantly learning bits and pieces about her over and over again throughout the movie. So having, you know, sort of her theme being, you know, played is pretty great. And I watched the DVD or the Blu-ray that I have has an awful lot of VAM, value added material. And through watching all of it in the same night as I watched the movie, like I learned that the fellow who created that music, and I am completely blanking on his
David
name.
David Raskin? Raxin? Something
yes,
like
Raskin,
that?
Yes. How, you know, there's the biography episode about Jean Tierney. He's talking about just how beautiful she was, and you know he was writing it because, you know, and looking at her every day and thinking about, you know, how beautiful she was, and that helped spur him on. But then also in another short little documentary episode thing, it talks about how Raskin's wife had sent him basically a Dear John letter and he got that and wrote the music just afterwards. So it's sort of haunting and a little bit sad because he was pouring his own sadness into this music. Aww. And I think it just works really, really well.
I think you've convinced me. Because I've seen it so many times, I don't feel like I'm objective about it because I've always enjoyed it. And it's the kind of, I find myself humming it, right? And because I noticed so many versions of it from when he turns on the radio, it comes on to, like I say, the little bit at the restaurant to the various places it appears as interstitial music as we're moving from scene to scene. I want to be in the love it camp, and I think I still am, although I can see how somebody, if they were just, you know, soulless or whatever, might decide that they didn't like it. I don't know. Annette, do you have thoughts on the music?
Because I was so focused on the murder mystery part of it, I can't even tell you what the music was. So I'm sure it felt cohesive. It didn't really jump out to me at all. So I'm going to say I can't even express feelings about it because it was there. Enough. It existed. I know there was music. Well, I don't know. So yeah, I was just like so focused on the story aspect being in the first time. You're focused on those surface things. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that story. So we find out that Laura has, in fact, not been killed. Lydecker is our murderer. Big spoiler there. But he intended to kill her because he's if I can't have her, nobody can, basically. But he killed Diane Redfern instead because he shot into the apartment. Diane Redfern is wearing Laura's clothes, and somehow the angle at which he shot made it impossible for him to know. Oh, sorry, wrong number. Although I guess if he already had a shotgun in his hand, that would have been sort of awkward.
And the lights were
blinded by rage.
And the lights were off, right? So Diane, who we never meet, it's convenient that she's shot in the face, because then we don't, you know, until they've had the time to evaluate her body, they don't know that there's anything amiss. And then when Lydecker is confronted with the living Laura, who just sort of shows up at her apartment after having been gone for a weekend, he faints. And I think that, well, he falls down. He doesn't faint. He doesn't seem to lose consciousness. But the thing I find weird, and I sort of wonder if this was just a Clifton Webb thing, was that they show Laura, they pan over to the door where he is, you see a reaction, then they pan away from him, and the next time you see him, he's on the ground. And I wonder if maybe Clifton Webb was just like, I don't want to fall down.
Ah, could be.
Because I felt it was weird to me. Like, I'm used to movies of that era panning away from something like, oh, I don't know, a naked guy in a bathtub or somebody getting shot in the head. But that just seemed like a weird situation in which to pan away. Or maybe just Waldo Lydecker doesn't look graceful falling down. So they
could be. I mean, there were another thing that one of the directors that was interviewed on one of the documentaries was talking about was how you get camera moves that aren't necessarily super common at that time, like swish pans and, you know, the tracking in and out in ways that are not quite the usual. So, I mean, this might have just been another case of Preminger deciding to, you know, let's just do something that's a little bit extra, because this movie is a little bit extra.
It is. And the plot becomes convoluted in the sense that, like I say, we have this mistaken identity killing. And then the way he's covered his tracks is that he's left this shotgun inside a grandfather clock in Laura's apartment, which is like one in his own house. And he gave her the clock. And then later on, when McPherson discovers this, he leaves the shotgun there. And this piece of evidence that's vital, he leaves to go away. And then the gun is still there, so that when Lydecker comes to try and kill Laura at the end of the movie again, it's available for him.
Is that like, I realized that that's a ridiculous thing. I was just like, really? He's just putting it back. I mean, he did take the cartridges as evidence, but he left the
with his
the whole
bare
thing.
Hands.
Well, I mean, what do they know about fingerprints?
And then later says something about fingerprints, because I was like, oh, do they not?
Right.
Oh, no, but yeah.
But I wondered, like, are there specific rules in terms of, like, the whole clock is now evidence and we have to take the whole thing as one piece? Like, my headcanon is that particular police department is very particular about their forensics department. And he just wanted to make sure that everything was left exactly the way that it was, so that, you know, the CSI of 1944
somebody can come and take pictures or whatever. And I guess, as it turns out, like, if he had taken it and then Lydecker comes back to the apartment and the shotgun is not there, then he's alerted. And it may have been more difficult for them to conclusively prove that he's the murderer. Although, I don't know.
I thought it was a classic circumstantial evidence of the gun being in there, which is like very, well, probably that's why he wanted the clock. But that's still circumstantial. We need to prove that he knew that gun was in there and it was a trap, except for the fact that then he proceeds to leave and not be like, they didn't set up a trap per se.
Right.
So it's just like, that was what I was expecting, was like, now we can trap him and see if he does something to go get the gun.
Right. And they had made a mistake in the sense of the other guy who's supposed to be tailing Lydecker, they had miscommunicated, which allowed Lydecker to, you know, get to Laura. And it's just like, it could have been a little Keystone Cop thing going on.
It wasn't really a miscommunication, though, because he was supposed to tail Lydecker when he left. And Lydecker never leaves, because he just goes back in through the kitchen entrance where we see, what is it, Bessie?
Yes,
I love Bessie so much.
I love her. Oh, right. We should talk about Bessie, because she's Laura's maid, and she is just so distraught, which, of course, immediately when you first meet her makes you think, oh, she's a good suspect. Because there'd be a great reveal later in the movie, Laura did something terrible to me. But is it happens. She's just, she's so devoted to her employer. Again, everybody's devoted to Laura. She's so devoted to her employer that even after Laura's dead, Bessie keeps showing up for work because she's paid up through the end of the week.
Yeah, Bessie's devotion to her and, like, as you said before, Shelley, like, we don't really see a lot of Laura being this warm, perfect, kind person, but we do get a lot of information from other people and from, you know, third party sources. Bessie, just played by Dorothy Adams, loves her so much, and, you know, so much that she actually takes the two scotch glasses and washes them and puts away the cheap booze, because even though Laura's dead, she doesn't want her memory besmirched and, like, run through the mud and the papers and stuff. And then you also have Shelby talking to McPherson about how, you know, Laura is just such a kind person, and she always wants to make sure that everybody around her is happy, and, like, you know, you don't really need to. I can't remember if that was him or if it was Waldo Lidecker. Somebody was talking about how she just, like, you know, she cares so much about the people around her and she should really not. I'm like, which why is, not?
Right. Which is not something you get a lot of evidence for when you meet her. But she's under stress. I mean, she's just come. She returns from the weekend and there's a strange guy in her apartment. And he tells her.
A sexy guy.
A sexy guy. But then he's asking her questions. And then it's a whole thing. Like, the last half of the movie, like, just from her point of view, it's kind of a rough go.
It is, especially since, speaking of traps, he literally tries to trap her in the, you know, the very classic mystery scene. You know, I'm sure you're wondering why I've all brought you all together here. Like, and then he literally on the phone says, you know, yes, I'm about to make the arrest. I'm going to bring the murderer in. And everybody's like, and he brings in her. And I love the fact that he has to bring her to the police station because he's gotten to the point where he needs these official surroundings,
which we've never seen before. And he puts her under harsh lights, makes her look terrible for a second until she goes, could you turn those off?
Giving her the third degree, man.
Right.
He's got to know.
So we talked about Lidecker going into the kitchen, but the image that made me kind of gasp was when, you know, it's coming and she's turning off the lights and she's going off to her bed and she's doing her, like, preparations to go to bed, and then you're just waiting because, you know, you're like, what's gonna happen? But, like, what the moment when the door swings open and he's standing there and, like, there's all these, like, sharp shadows and everything, I'm like, oh no. And it actually, like, just gave me a shiver. It was just such a great, because, yeah, they built it up so beautifully. And then that was, like, the scariest moment. And then it's just sort of all, you're like, well, we know it's, like, he's not going to succeed.
It's really well done because they take two beats, because he comes into her apartment. She's off stage. And eventually she hears a sound. But they don't have the confrontation right then when they could. They cut away, they come back, and there's a point where you almost think it might not happen and that McPherson might get back in time to, I mean, he obviously gets back in time to save her, but that he might get back in time to catch Lidecker before he even gets that close. And they give you that second, like, oh crap, this is really bad. She's toast now, because he at first he's putting the shotgun together, he's pulling it out of the grandfather clock, but then the thing with the shadows and him standing behind the door doesn't occur for several beats after that.
And I find it so, like, I'm just so tickled by the fact that this movie starts with a voiceover from Waldo Lidecker, you know, narrating how he first met the detective, and then he narrates the flashback of how he brought Laura into society. And now at the end we get, you know, he's not actually narrating, but it's his radio spot that he is obviously pre-recorded that Laura, for some reason, is listening to.
Right.
And, you know, and it's all about love and stuff. So it's almost like he is narrating his very actions as
he is
going in to really, you know, make the murder stick this time. It's really well done.
It is. Well, I just wanted to throw in, because these actors are all interesting, whether they're all at their most interesting in this movie or not, I want to point to other movies each of these actors made that if you like them, you might want to check out. For Jean Tierney, it has to be Leave Her to Heaven, a movie which I won't even describe to you because it's astonishing. And we might actually do it on the show at some point, but she is amazing in it. Let's just say she's not the nicest person.
I like not nice people in
movies. It's something else. Vincent Price, obviously his whole horror library, but he made a lot of movies in the 40s and early early 50s that are in the noir genre or in other genres. And one I really like is His Kind of Woman. He has a supporting role. It's basically a Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer movie. But Vincent Price plays this maybe sinister, maybe not supporting character. And he's kind of amazing. Dana Andrews, the last thing I saw him in, and this is really sort of a throwaway and a cheat, and is not his best work, but it makes me laugh. The last thing I saw Dana Andrews in was Ball of Fire, which we watched for Lions, Towers, and Shields, and he plays the thug who is after Barbara Stanwyck, not a role that Andrews played very often, because after Laura, he starts playing like leading men, either good guys or people who are being tortured by Susan Hayward as his alcoholic wife, which happens a lot, but... Dana Andrews in Ball of Fire, you'll just be like, oh, I've never seen that before. So wow. Those would be my picks.
I might have signed up for that episode if I had remembered he was in that movie. I've never seen that one.
It's a really small part, and he's kind of stiff in it, but it's still funny because he's very off type for that one. Mm-hmm.
So. My favorite other Dana Andrews performance, I think this is my favorite just because I love this movie so much, but The Best Years of Our Lives is another one.
Oh, like, you're right.
You got to devote some time and like, you know, settle in. And it's got a lot of amazing actors doing a lot of really amazing performances, but I just really, really love him as he's one of the three soldiers who comes home after World War II, and the whole movie is about adjusting to, you know, to life as a veteran when the world has moved on and you have changed in different ways. And I feel like his performance in that is really, really, like, it just it gets to my heart.
You're right. It's quite a long movie, but it's worth it. Like, you don't.
Yep.
And it's a slice of life movie in the sense that yes, there's a plot, but really what you're doing is getting familiar with those characters and getting comfortable with an understanding of what it's like for each of these individual guys who's come home from the war. And basically the world that they come back to, it's not that they're different. It's not only that they're different. It's that the world that they come back to is very different. And that kind of messes with them a little bit. So yes, recommended. Yep. Well, Annette Weirstra, Erica Ensign, well, thanks so much for joining me for this discussion of Laura. I'm really glad you were here. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm here for all the noir stuff, for the record.
Awesome.
Mysteries, murder.
Interestingly enough, too, like, this movie, it starts out as a noir, but by the end, it's more a like romantic mystery, right. which is delightful. So, like,
the best combination.
If there, Shelley, if there are other movies like that that are noirish and, like, you know, where it ends up being a romance where there's not
murder
a femme
romance.
Fatale, like, it's just a nice female who like sign me up for those too.
I will point those out because there are a few of those. Now, that is a good segue for me because the next movie we're going to talk about on Lions, Towers, and Shields is Nightmare Alley. Definitely a film noir, a romantic lead in the sense that Tyrone Power is a romantic lead, not a nice man at all. And I don't know that you would call the love story delightful or romantic, but if you like noir, I'm really selling it, huh? No, Nightmare Alley is a surprising movie, especially if you have any sort of thoughts of Tyrone Power as the swashbuckling, beautiful leading man. He's kind of different in this one. So stay tuned
already
for that.
Already sold.
All right. Well, there's still opportunities. Jump in. If you want to keep up with this show, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. And while you're there, become a member of The Incomparable because, well, their shirts and things. You can also follow this show on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield because S's are extra. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. And at all those places, feel free to give us your feedback or suggest movies that you might like to have us cover on future episodes. Bye for now.